So I hope the break we had gave you a chance to practice. Let's be honest and realistic here. The way TSK practice tends to work, a lot of the time, not always, but a lot of the time, is that when you start to do a practice, or when some new insight or some new approach or suggestion about how to see things is proposed, and you work with it for a while, it seems very interesting and very worth exploring. And then after a while, your interests shift, or another way to say that is that, your standard way of engaging the world, or your standard vision of the world, because remember, this is a new vision that we're trying to put in place. So that standard vision comes back into play. It kind of heals itself from the puncture wound of a new version of reality, and you forget to do the practice. So in a space of 2 weeks like this, maybe sometimes you were really engaging, investigating, and maybe sometimes you kind of forgot about it. But that's why we're here today, is to reinvigorate and re-encourage people to be looking at time. That's really the kind of basic instruction for this whole sequence. See how time operates in your lives. And then we will do our best in these classes, and also through the online program, and some of the specific sessions we're going to set up, we'll do our best to help stimulate that engagement. And the basic idea here is that once you start to question time, or for that matter, start to question, almost anything of significance in your world, your version of how reality gets set up, it's tremendously interesting. It's very exciting. It's a path of discovery, and yet, we have our ways of falling back into the ordinary. So that's just a standard dynamic that goes back and forth. So in that context, or with that introduction, let me mention a couple of things. One is, I am not sure if we have if I have said specifically in the past when we're going to be doing a TSK workshop at Rock and Ling next summer. I know I've said we were doing one, but let me tell you, we're going to be doing a workshop next summer from August 8th through 11th. So that's a long weekend. I think it's a Thursday evening through a Sunday afternoon. And we have tried this several times in the past, in the last few years, and really haven't gotten enough participation. I know that a lot of people who are in this course are located in various places around the world. So you may not want to make your way out to California just for a 4-day retreat. But my suggestion initially was that you could combine it with a private retreat. Or in other ways, we could find a way to expand that. You could do a retreat at the Nyingma Institute. Wouldn't be about TSK probably, but it might, I'm sure it would be very valuable. So I encourage you to think about that. The reason we're setting it up so early this year is because so that people can make space for it in their calendars and really seriously think about it. It helps. To be able to engage this on a maybe not quite 24-hour basis, but on a 12-hour basis, or to really put your focus on TSK for several days in a row, things open up differently. So that's the first thing. The second thing I wanted to mention is that we had talked about having a practice day for this class. Those of you who've been here before, who've been taking part before, know how that works. The basic idea is that I will suggest a set of practices. They will basically be the practices been doing during the session. And then on a Sunday morning, the usual time in this would be in January, we will come together and discuss our practices, and especially the idea here would be to post on the website some comments about your practice, and that'll give us something to work with when we come together. So I didn't actually look at the specific date, but it would probably be right around the Sunday in the middle of January. That's what I'm thinking for the practice day. So we'll announce that later. That's the second thing. The third thing I wanted to announce was that I'm thinking about making a change in the way the posts are handled, the way our discussion is handled. There'd be a kind of te slightly technical side to it, and I can send you an email about that. I mean, it'll be easy, but it'll be a slight change. But the real point here is, I'm thinking I'd like for people's discussions to be open to visitors rather than being password protected. I think our practice session we could still make password protected. But I'd like the discussion to be open because, first of all, I think it's interesting and helpful for visitors. And second, because I'm concerned that when people come to the CCI website right now, it looks as though nothing is happening. And that's not true. We have this program happening, and there's a fairly active discussion that goes on, and I'd like for people to see that. So maybe you can be thinking about that and commenting on it. Maybe what I'll do is post something about that, and then there can be comments on that post. But that would be my choice at the moment to make that public. And I realize there's a downside to that, so I look forward to your comments. Okay, well, let's talk about the reading for this week. We are in the middle of the chapter, which is what, chapter 9 or chapter 10. And this chapter focuses on the past. And it is possible to lose sight of where we're going when we read very slowly like this. So to get a little bit of a bigger picture, the first chapter in the section on time points out some of the problems with our usual understanding of time, and that's where we got the focus of doing past, present, and future. The second chapter, the one we're on now, looks at the past. And that's what we're going to be discussing today and next week. And next week we finish the chapter. And then the chapter that follows, which we will start in session 6 and then continue for those of you who go on, we'll continue that in the winter, in January. That chapter starts to deal with the future. So time as a whole, and now the past, and we're going to be looking at the future. That's the overview of where we're going. So of course, our usual understanding of time is this linear understanding. Everybody really knows this. It's the line, the kind of one-dimensional line, and there's a moving point in the middle, which we call the present, and then there's the past behind us, and there's the future ahead of us. Other cultures have somewhat different models. For our purposes, that doesn't matter too much. I think in general, that's the model we follow. Maybe in some cases we think about it a little differently. But if you asked 100 people to describe how time works, I think you'd probably get at least 90, 95 of them giving you a picture, something like that. I've never done that, so maybe I'd be surprised. That's my working assumption. If anybody thinks they really do it very differently, let us know. Speak up or write something in the chat box. So that's our usual understanding. I'm going to assume that for now. And connected with that is the notion that time goes moment by moment. Along this line, there are discrete moments. One moment follows another. somehow they're connected to each other, and that the way that they get connected is very problematic. But we've already looked at that a little bit. What we've started to do, what we've been looking at, is looking at time in terms of each moment having a past, present, future structure. And that's an alternative model. It doesn't mean that necessarily that moments don't unfold one after another, although that might be tricky to see how that worked. But what it does suggest, and it gives us a way to practice that we've been working with, an alternative vision of reality. What it suggests is that in every moment you find this past and future right along with the present. And when you look at that, it turns out that moments maybe are not what we think they are either in terms of being these little points. You know, like our basic notion of time, and this is very unfortunate in a way, our basic notion of time comes from clocks, right? And so now we have digital clocks, which in a way goes to the heart of our usual understanding, because with digital clocks, each second pops up. With an analog clock, a regular old-fashioned clock, you have a second hand that sweeps along and you can't break it down. But with digital, it's very clear. It goes, pop, 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 pop. That's how time unfolds. And so we take our understanding of time from clocks. We think that's the way time is. Even though, in fact, the reality is that clocks are just there to measure time, whatever that means. And we've talked about that a little bit. That's all pretty much by way of background. And now we're going to be looking at what the reading says about time, and specifically the way it links time to identity. And then I want to go on and say something about the relationship between this identity model of time and the notion of lineage. And I talked about that a little in the orientation. And Rinpoche doesn't exactly contrast the two, but I'm going to. We're going to talk about identity first, and then we'll talk about lineage. So Rinpoche starts off with this idea that if we really want to investigate a moment in time, let's see exactly how he does it here. It's on page 82. He says, if we want to isolate out, if we want to investigate a point in time, I've been saying moment, he more typically says point. If we want to investigate a point, but he goes back and forth, then we're going to have to isolate it. And he says, well, it turns out that the only moment you can isolate is the first moment. Because, why? Because any other moment refers back, to use the term we're going to come to later, it refers back to its lineage. But it's, every moment is shaped by the influences that have determined its nature. So he's trying to isolate that out, and he says, well, let's look at the first moment. Now, I don't think we should take that too seriously, in the sense, and he says this specifically. He says, I'm not saying there is a first moment. That's an open question. We don't have to worry about that. It's just that if we're trying to get clear on what a moment might be, we're going to have an isolated moment. And it turns out that the only candidate, he says, is the first moment, because every other moment is too caught up in the way that time unfolds, or the flow of time. Every other moment is too closely linked to the past and future, in other words, to other moments. But in the first moment, there's no link, at least going backwards. You might say there's a moment, there's a link going forward, but he doesn't so much go there. What he's using this for, because he's not claiming that this is the truth of the matter, what he's using this analysis for is to say a moment has to have an identity, and that's the way he gets into the notion of identities. The moment, in order to really talk about a moment, and in order to talk about anything at all, We have to identify it. And he talks about, on page 82, he talks about how identities, how does an identity come up? Well, you have to assign the identity, and then you have to record the identity. And I'm not going to focus on that particularly. But he is talking about our reliance on identities and saying that that's very much linked to the notion of time as we ordinarily understand it. Something gets taken up and passed along, as he said, and that is the identity. So there's the identity of a moment, but there's also the identity of the content of the moment. And I think it's worth thinking about this a little. So I'm going to say something about it, but see if you can think it through for yourself. I don't want to impose my particular version on you. If you think about how we live, what is our daily experience? It's made up of identities. As we go through the world, we encounter identities. I have, whenever we have these discussions, of course, I'm sitting in front of my computer at my desk, so that's what I see. There's no window in front of me, so I can't see, much of anything else. But there's all sorts of things around me, and they all have their own identities, right? And we tend to think of time in that same thing-like way. So a moment of time has its own identity. That's at least the assumption we make. Now, Sudi asks a question here. Aren't all these identities all subjectively assigned, like stories we create? Well, yes. I mean, the issue of stories, which brings in the narrative flow of time, is not something I think we want to focus on right now, although it's important, and you may want to be exploring it on your own. But he's not talking about that here. But he is definitely talking about assigning identities, and identity gets assigned. It gets assigned, and then it gets transmitted, or how does he say? So this is on page 82, where he says, we have to, in order to point toward the first moment, we must be able to identify it. This act of identification has several aspects. The identity must be assigned and then recorded. So you say, this is that moment. So we look back in time, and we say, well, there was the moment when I, joined this session, let's say. But that moment gets assigned. It is subjective. It's given an identity. It's given a name. And the nature of that name, or the nature of identity, is that it's the same. The very notion of identity means something that doesn't change. And actually, the root meaning, or the root of the word identity, is id, which means this. It means this thing, this same thing. An identity is something that has that, it's hard to say it because it's a really fundamental concept. It's something that's there. It's the same from one moment to the next. If it wasn't the same, then it wouldn't be an identity. Right? So identity is based on the notion of sameness, and yes, it's assigned, and it's in that sense it's subjective. Or at least you could say it has a knowing component to it. In other words, we have to know, in order to know something, we assign it an identity. That's really how it ordinarily works. And our notion of time goes along with that, but we don't have to worry about that at this very moment. Now, of course, you can, an identity can change. So if I take a, if I am holding a cup in my hand or a vase or something, and I drop it, then it shatters. And now the identity of the vase is gone. Now we have a lot of little pieces of vase that have their own identity, and the vase identity isn't there anymore. It's not the same. Right? It's actually interesting as an aside that in Buddhist philosophy and some kinds of Western philosophy make a similar point. They say that if you're trying to figure out what's ultimately real, what you're looking for is something whose identity can't be changed. So a vase isn't ultimately real because if you drop it and it breaks, there's no more vase. But atoms are ultimately real. You can't change their identity. So identity has this sense, it's related to essence, it's related to sameness, and our notion of time, as long as we have it in this linear version where we're where there's moments that succeed each other, the only thing that can mean really is that each moment has its own identity. And then it's gone, but and the its identity is well, it's kind of disappeared into the past, but the next moment is there and it has an identity too. The past has an identity. And in fact, all of this is closely identified with the past, and we're kind of headed in that direction in this reading. The future is much, that's harder to say. The future doesn't really have an identity because by definition, it's not like anything else. It's open, right? The future could be anything. We can predict sometimes with great likelihood what's going to be happening in the next moment or 5 minutes from now, but that's a guess at what its identity is going to be when it arrives. And the present actually also doesn't have an identity, because we can see that the present is always shifting, right? Even on the model of time unfolding along this line, the present is just the moment that I'm occupying right now. And I guess you could think of that as a kind of identity if you say, well, I define the present as the moment that I occupy. But then in the next moment, the present is still there, or there is a present there, but it's not the same present. Everything about it has changed. It's still, you could say, I haven't changed. So I still occupy the present, but everything else about the moment, about the present has changed. So it's very difficult to say that the present has any identity. Maybe you could say that whatever, that my identity is expresses itself partly through my being present in the moment. But that's not the usual sense of identity. So the basic point here then is that identification, assigning an identity, means looking back on something and then assigning that identity and passing it on, sort of recognizing it, giving it status as what we've identified, as the identity we've assigned. So here's another question from Sudhi. Is that why is that why when subject-object duality gets lighter and kind of falls away, the identities fall away, and more freedom seems to arrive, more aliveness and openness of all kinds of emergence? Well, yes, we're very tied in to identity, and actually in the next reading, the next section for next week, we're going to be talking more about the identity of the self. Right now, we started off by focusing on the identity of the moment, and that leads us to talk, at least it leads me, to talk about the identity of objects. But there's also, of course, this identity of the self, which we understand to persist over time. And if we're not so identity-centered, then the identity of the self is also not going to play the same role, and so there will be a sense, a greater sense of freedom. That's right. And we will be looking at that more next week. What that suggests, and this is true for the identity of objects and the identity of the self, is that identity is based on the past. In order to identify something, that we look back on it and we assign it a meaning, an identity. So we say, this just happened. And when we do that, we're giving it a coherence that we understand as persisting across time. That's what identity is. It's the sameness. So if you see a vase, and you see, in the present, you say, we say, okay, so right now I'm looking at a vase. But that identity of the vase is caught up in the word vase. And it's not that we have to say the word to ourselves, but looking at it, we know what it is. And we know what it is because we've looked back at the identity that we've assigned. So identity and the past are very closely connected to each other. So here's a question from Michael. Good. Does the experience of the present have an identity as opposed to the present itself? It seems the whole idea that our present experience is formed by a lineage must have a locus to which this lineage applies. And since we only have this present experience, can we say that its felt lineage provides it with an identity? Well, I'm not sure about connecting that up with lineage, and we haven't gotten there yet, so let's keep that part of the question in mind. But I think the distinction that you make is important. There is a we at least imagine that there's a present. Maybe even before any identity has been assigned. I mean, it's a little tricky to say that, but the distinction still is helpful because you're saying we experience the present. There's the present, and then we experience the present. And are those two things the same? Well, not exactly. Because in order to experience something, we assign it an identity. So it may be that if the present is active in our lives, it's active in an unidentified way. I was just reading something this morning, actually, which talks about a kind of non-positioned consciousness, and maybe you could use that term, a non-position, the identity, or the present is non-positioned. It's when we turn it into an experience that it takes on an identity. So you might say, well, wait, we don't have to turn it into an experience. It already is an experience. Not so clear. I mean, we may not have another word for other than experience, but there is this distinction. The moment I want to talk about something, or the moment I want to engage something, it's the thingness that turns it into an experience. I experience the thing, but there may be something before the experiencing. Because experience is going to be tied up with this idea of identity. I experience this moment, or I experience this object, and clearly it's going to be tied up with the one who's doing the experiencing, with the identity of the one who's doing the experiencing. Now, let's see if we can look back when we talk about lineage in a moment and see how that works. But I want to go on for now. So what happens really when you identify is you turn the thing that you've identified into an object. And parallel with that, you turn yourself as the one who's experiencing or naming, you turn yourself into the subject. Right? And that goes along with this notion of time unfolding from moment to moment. And the thing that Rinpoche points out then is that when that's our model for how experience unfolds, we're privileging the past. We're saying that everything has to happen in an identified way, which means that everything has already happened, and that's why he uses the term happened, which I think is wonderfully creative use of language. So it's not that everything has already happened. It still makes sense to talk about the future and the past and the present, but everything unfolds in terms of identities, and that means that everything is centered on the past, which is where the identity points. And that's why he says everything has happened it. So, if I did have a window in front of me and I looked out the window and I saw a cat, let's say, then I could say, I see a cat, right? And the next moment the cat's still there, and so I could say, I see a cat again, right? That way of describing what's going on has the identity of the eye who's doing the seeing, it has the identity of the cat that is being seen, and then it also has, because those are there, it really has the identity of the moment in which the seeing is taking place. It's all based on identity. So the model here, it seems to me, is something like, well, maybe you could say rocks in a stream. It's like we're caught up in this stream that just keeps flowing. It's constantly flowing, but as we are moving through this stream, there are things that show up, and they're like the rocks in the stream. Or if you imagine being on some vast plain, and on this plain there are various objects, and those objects, those rocks in the stream, or those things that pop up, those are the identities. And you could say each one of those identities has a lineage. It's there because of its past. Let's leave it loose like that. The past is central. That really is the point. Truly, the point I want to make, and he puts that in terms of the happened it. In order to be able to say, here is this, to be able to point to something even, we're privileging the past, and we're privileging the notion of identity, and all of that is built into our usual understanding of time. So here's another question from Sudhi. I wonder if Rinpoche talks about non-positioned experience in terms of touching the roots of perception before it stems and buds into my, me, my, mine, and me, the second and third levels of perception. Okay, so I happen to know that Sudhi is referring to a reading in a class that she's taking that at the institute that I'm teaching. So this image of the roots and the buds. But it's certainly true that the experience, the identity-based experience, is already at the end of a process. A meaning has been assigned, it's been passed down, there's identification, cognition, kind of objectification, you might say, and there's the affirmation of the self as the one who's having this experience. All of that takes place, and all of that has happened before any particular present moment can be identified. So all of that is the past, and the notion of being in a non-positioned consciousness, a non-positioned awareness, would be a way of saying, well, maybe we don't have to follow that whole path. We don't have to go through the dynamic of experience. But the approach we're going to take right now is a little different from that. It's consistent with that, but it's different because we want to start looking at this idea of lineage. So we'll have time to do that today. I was going to do some practice, and I don't know if we'll have time to do that. But let's talk a little about lineage. So First, we have this notion of time unfolding with mo through moment after moment after moment, which is linked to the idea of identity. That's what we've been looking at. But then there's also the lineage of appearances. So something shows up, and Michael talked about, our present experience is formed by a lineage, and that's right. In other words, this moment got here. It didn't just pop into existence. That's how we see it. Now, maybe it does pop into existence, but we are very confident that there is some sort of sequencing going on, and that has to do with lineage. So one way of thinking about lineage is that it's just a way of describing what we've been talking about so far today. There's a place on page 84 where Rinpoche uses the word lineage in exactly that way, in the third full paragraph, and he's summarizing the analysis he's been doing, and the analysis leads to the notion that we're always focused on the past, right? He says earlier on the page, he says, in the moment that we specify the present, we turn it into the past. So it turns out that all we ever have available to us is recorded moments of past time. So now he's going to summarize that. He says, if time consists of moments that arise in succession, our usual model, each specified by the lineage of moments that have preceded it, each recorded in time, in turn, then all of time is past time. So here he's using lineage just as a kind of, as a term for all of the moments that have preceded this moment, which is very consistent with what we've been talking about. Let me not pass by the last sentence in that paragraph because it helps point to the significance of all of this. He says, when we go through this process and we essentially turn time into past time so that everything has already happened, we lose the dynamic of time, right? Time and the dynamic of its arising is unavailable, gone from the outset. That's the reason this matters. We're living a life in which the dynamic of time is not available to us, or very rarely available to us. And that's because of this structure, and it's because we have focused on the past. Everything has already happened. So when he uses lineage there, that's just another way of describing this process. But there's if we go back a little earlier into the reading from last week, there is another understanding of what lineage is about. This is in the second full paragraph on page 80. He says, well, let's think about the past in terms of history. And he says history is something limited. You might say, he doesn't say it quite this way here, but you might say that history is a story that gets told, and so that story can't include everything. So it's inherently limited, and he says partly that means that the past has already taken form and it can't be altered. So it's limited in that sense. But he's actually has something else in mind. He says, as our concerns and interests shape present experience, the past is realigned accordingly. We could say that there are different lineages of time, each recorded in accord with its specific nature and qualities, each transmitting forward, each actively feeding into the present to give the present its specific form. And that's a very different sense of lineage, and that's the one that I want to suggest we look at and work with as an alternative to the notion of linear time. So, lineage, the word lineage, clearly it comes from the word line, and it's very closely related to the word linear, but it also has a different meaning, and the dictionary definition, if you go back, if you look at the OED and it talks about the early uses of the term. And basically, lineage is about heritage. It has to do with families, family clans, or some, a lot of you are probably familiar with the idea of lineage in terms of the lineage of a teacher being passed down to his student, right? The basic point is that lineage involves qualities. Linear time doesn't. It's just one moment after another, and every moment gets filled up with content. Lineage, in its very nature, involves qualities. So I actually copied a couple of quotations from the dictionary, which are the typical way we use it. I am not of so base a lineage, somebody says. I mean, the term is kind of old-fashioned or literary. It's only used in writing. Maybe in religious context, it's different. But I'm not of so base a lineage. So the lineage has qualities. It's base or it's noble, right? Here's a similar term. I have been thought to disgrace my lineage. So lineage holds certain qualities and attributes. And that's very much consistent with the way Rinpoche uses the term in the passage I quoted. There are different lineages and there are different pasts. If you look at the lineage, if you look at the lineage of this moment, you could look at it in terms of how it inherits, you could say, the past half hour that we've been working through, or it could be the past of this course, or it could be the past that involves your engagement with the time-space knowledge teachings, or it could be a lineage that has to do with how it fits into the flow of your day-to-day. There are many, many different lineages available, and there's a kind of a multidimensionality once you get into this. So you're working with the past, but you're working with the past in a way that allows for many possibilities. And that freedom is a way of getting at a kind of non-positioning. So I'm coming back to Sudi's point about non-positioned experience. And you could try to do that. You could try to get to a place of freedom, of non-positioning, by stripping away the whole structure of identity. But what we're talking about here is a little different. We're not stripping it away, but we're recognizing that there are multiple lineages. So there's no one position. And we can be non-positioned in that sense. We can be aware of how events arise through the lineage that leads to their arising. And so to go back to Michael's question about present experience being formed by a lineage, it is. And he says, so since we only have this present experience, can we say that its felt limit lineage provides it with an identity? Yes and no. Yes, if we are staying with the model of identity that we started with, but no, if we allow for the possibility of differentiating lineages in time, so that we are the inheritors of a vast range of possibilities. That's what lineage suggests. So we're over time here, but let me just point to a couple of things very quickly. If we understand lineage in the sense of just all the moments that preceded this moment, which is the kind of identity-based version of lineage, then it just leads to objectivity and subjectivity, as we've been saying. But we know from our own experience that there are other richer possibilities for experience than just it's the causal sequence, what leads to this, what leads to that. And the notion of lineage leads us in that direction. So in that context, I wanted to read you something that's taken from a different part of Dynamics. It's on page, well, let's see, actually. I guess, yeah, let me look at this one. It's on page 144, in the last paragraph. And it's talking about, how shall we say this? It's saying that, well, it's saying that appearance manifests knowledge. Okay? And this has to do with the notion of multiple lineages and not being positioned. He says, once we realize that appearance manifests knowledge, limits on knowledge are no longer binding. And then he gives it says something, this is what I'm interested in. He says, the depth of our love becomes the inward intensity of time. Now that kind of comes out of nowhere in terms of what we've been discussing, but it's related to what we've been discussing. It's related to the notion that we are losing the dynamic of time. And that's really what Rinpoche means, I think, when he talks about the inward intensity of time. And the suggestion is that when we contact that inward intensity, we touch something much deeper, and that's what he's referring to when he talks about the depth of our love. Right? The possibility of looking at time in terms of lineages instead of in terms of differentiated lineages, instead of looking at it as a linear flow, begins to open that up, and that's what we want to look at. So for next week, we didn't have time clearly to do any practice here in the session, which is unfortunate, but that's how it is. There is actually an exercise in one of the other TSK books. It's the one called Knowledge of Time and Space. There's an exercise called Tracing Lineages. It's actually presented as a space exercise, but I will point that out to you and give you some guidance on it in the orientation. But hopefully what we've done now sets that up. And then in the reading for next week, we're going to be applying this more directly to the self and its relationship to time. So that's where we stand. That's where we are for today. I'll try to post the orientation very soon. Thank you for your comments and questions. I hope it's a productive week.